Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Should we feel guilty about our national love affair with football? The drama of the game and the brute strength of its best players can be dazzling to watch. And for many of us, football is a great excuse to gather for quality time with friends and family. It's a little harder to admit that we are as fascinated by the violent tackles as the flawless passes, especially when those plays leave some athletes acutely injured in the short term and at significant risk for brain damage in the long term. Yet my guest is convinced the time has come to take a critical look at the downsides of football and to ask what it says about our culture that we've chosen to overlook them for so long. The new book by journalist and author Steve Almond is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You open the book by describing a clipping you kept of an account from the newspaper of a Patriots-Dolphins game in 2003. First of all, what did that clipping talk about?
Well, the clipping was just described a play. It was just standard sports reporting. I can even read it to you if you want. It's
sure.
It's just standard sports. It just reads, with 13 minutes and 50 seconds left of the game, running back Kevin Faulk of the Patriots hauled in a 15-yard pass from quarterback Tom Brady, then got leveled by Miami safety Brock Marion, who forced a fumble and left Faulk motionless on the ground. Quote, "I wasn't out cold, but I was out," said Faulk. Asked if he remembered lying on the ground, he said, "No, I don't, so I must have been out. I knew that something was wrong with me. I knew that, like, it wasn't normal. I didn't have that same normal feeling when I got up." So I don't, you know, this is one of the things, like, in my office is just a blizzard of weird, evocative little talismans and clippings. And I put it up over my desk, and I looked at it for many years. And I think initially, Chris, like, my conscious motivation was just how crazy that these guys put their bodies at such risks. And, you know, it was like Faulk was offering sort of the linguistic equivalent of a concussion. Like, he literally just had no idea exactly what had happened to him. And that was sort of a posture of ironic distance, like, wow, look at those barbaric guys and what they'll put their bodies and minds through. I thought it was funny, in other words. And then something pretty profound happened in my life, which is that my mother suffered an acute dementia. I flew from my home in Boston out to California and showed up at the ICU unit. And my mom, who's a Yale-educated doctor who'd been practicing up until she fell, was one of the smartest people I knew, was literally gone. She didn't know where she was. She didn't know who I was the whole time. And really, until you see that up close, people have this romantic notion of, well, the identity resides in your soul or it resides in your heart. And that's nonsense. Who you are is in your brain. That's what makes you who you are. And when your brain is gone, you're gone. So I think that was the moment where I realized that that clipping was actually about me. I was the one who was not connecting those two synapses in my brain, the one that says, oh, this is such a great form of entertainment. It's so exciting to watch these guys bash against one another and catch balls and run down the field and get tackled. And the part of my brain that was saying, wait a second, you are consuming a form of violence that's so profound that some of these guys are going to wind up just like your mother. So I think that was the place where it finally became real for me.
We should be clear, as you are in the book, that you like watching football. Before you had qualms about the game and how it was played, what were your favorite things about it?
Not only do I like watching football, I still love watching football. I feel like a recovering alcoholic. Like, it's not like I'm ever going to stop being a football fan. I'm just struggling, especially this time of year, ardently struggling not to be drawn in by the game. What I think is so amazing about football is that there's a whole bunch of things, but I'll limit it to a few. It's dramatically, as a writer, the narrative structure of football is absolutely breathtaking. You have this kind of exposition where the quarterback is calling the play, everybody lines up, and they all start to move at once. And the number of contingencies that what can happen on a football field at one time is just spellbinding to me as a fan and a fairly sophisticated fan. The number of things that have to happen that these guys have to factor in. And it's not just the quarterback and the receivers, the skill players. It's everybody who has to really, you know, it's so complicated you need like 10 coaches to keep it all straight in a giant playbook. And yet, in its essence, it reconnects us to the intuitive pleasures of childhood. At the basic level, it is about watching athletic greatness. And one thing that we love as Americans is to watch people who are great, and especially in intuitive ways where it's just in their body, whether it's a beautiful singer or Barry Sanders or Tony Dorsett making just the right cut at just the right time, breaking away from the tackle into the open field on his way to a touchdown. I mean, just feel it, talking about it and watching it. It is very powerful. My book is a powerful celebration of how beautiful. I view it as a kind of intricate form of art, football. So that's part of what the book is about. It's just that it's attached to these other aspects, the dark side of football, that are so disturbing.
Do they have to whale each other in order for the game to be good?
Well, I'll tell you what, that we make that decision as fans. And the only thing I would ask people to consider is, you know, there's a reason why Roger Goodell isn't saying, OK, well, it's clear that this game, like, you know, he's basically somebody who could look at the situation. He has all the medical data. He has a staff of lawyers. They're being sued for $1 billion. He knows that that his players are getting hurt playing the game profoundly, and some of them in a long-term irreparable way. He could make a two-hand touch, but he's not going to do that. And that's because we, the fans, actually do want to consume the violence. That's why you have parabolic mics on the sidelines that pick up every bone-crunching decibel of every hit. That's why you have endless replays of the most dramatic hits. That's why when you go to a football game, whether you like it or not, there is an involuntary limbic reaction when there's a big hit and you hear the crowd go, ooh. Mm. That's something that is very primal, that's deep inside of us. And that is why fans turn to the game. And I will say that most fans are men, but it's why all fans turn to the game. And if we're really honest with ourselves, that is it contained within the artistic or the excellence that we're seeing is the ability to inflict punishment and to absorb punishment silently and without complaint. That is the kind of compact that we make with athletes. We consume them when they're young. We consume their grace, their elegance, their courage, their valor, even if it becomes self-punishing or masochistic. And I think mostly we just don't want to think about them later in their lives.
And they're no longer on our television screens, in the headlines. Once they start to have these problems, they're gone from the field. And so we can pretend it just didn't happen.
I think that's largely what people do, and it is what people did for years and years. In a sense, the NFL is a victim of its own success. You know, Chris, it's five times more popular than the next popular sport. It's not just a little more popular than any other game. It is our national religion. And every single player who makes it, even at the college level, is a pretty huge celebrity. Even a Division III player who's really good for his team is a celebrity within his given community. Never mind the, you know, Peyton Mannings and Tom Brady's and Wes Welker's of the world, or the Des Bryant's or Tony Romo's. Those guys are international superstars. And the fact of the matter is we now pay attention to what they do, everything that they do. They're part of the fame game that America's so good at. So when a guy like Junior Seau, who spent 15 years bashing into guys, one of the fiercest linebackers in the history of the game, when he kills himself and it becomes clear from his family that he was suffering from profound dementia, what's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, for years before that, well, we're going to see that and we're going to be forced to confront that. I feel that the country is at a kind of moral crossroads right now, that fans are at a moral crossroads. And my book, which is really coming a little bit late, I think, is just an effort from the inside of the game, as somebody who loves the game, to say, look, it's many beautiful, intricate, alluring, suspenseful, stirring things, but it is at the center of it a profoundly violent collision game, and we are consuming that violence.
And we are starting to see some outcry from particularly former superstars who say enough is enough. Let's listen here to former Dallas Cowboy Tony Dorsett talking to the Associated Press in 2012.
You know, they use you up. No matter what the circumstances are, it's all about winning games, football games, regardless, you know, and they don't care because they figure, you know, we got replacement factories, which are colleges. And so they just put you out there and, you know, feed you to the wolves. And if you make it through, fine. If you don't, that's fine, you know.
That was Tony Dorsett. And this, of course, Steve, is a man who really reached the pinnacles of success in the NFL. Can you talk a little bit about what his experience have been with injuries that he sustained or believes he sustained while he was playing?
I don't think he believes he sustained them. I mean, anybody who watched Tony Dorsett play knows that that guy, through the course of his career, Pitt before the Cowboys and before that high school in Pee Wee, he probably had, you know, 20, 30,000 small car accidents inside his helmet. A lot of this is just basic physics, Chris. Mass times acceleration equals force. These guys are bigger and stronger than they've ever been. The brain is a soft organ inside a hard skull. And what's really dangerous, the invisible killer, is not just the big catastrophic hits. It's these subconcussive hits, the tens of thousands of subconcussive hits. And they happen on every single play. It's not like they just happen when we see a big hit and everybody goes, ooh. Tony Dorsett absorbed tens of thousands of those. And what he's describing is a kind of capitalist drama, if you will. It's really the worker. We do use these guys up. We consume their youth. We love them. We worship them in their youth. You could say the same thing about a coal miner. You could say the same thing about anybody who works in a dangerous environment, who we look to, our soldiers. I mean, I try to draw that connection in the book. We clap for them in airports. We cheer when they go off to war. But we don't really want to see the wounded psychically or even physically disfigured people who come back, many of whom are deeply troubled. And what Tony Dorsett is describing is what any other pro football player, or even a football player who played at the highest level in college, describes, that you turn yourself into a projectile. And any of the memoirs you read of football players, I was amazed when I read, you know, a couple of these memoirs, and so much of it, Chris, is just about how banged up their bodies are. They are literally using up their bodies. And, you know, for me, Tony Dorsett represents a real moral crisis. If you're a really big fan of football, that means, in a sense, that you have a special interest and love and appreciation for football players and what they do. And what's fascinating to me, what I wonder about, is if you love those players so much and you admire them so much, doesn't that mean you kind of care about them? And so how is it that you can care about them and love them so much, and everybody out there who's got a Tony Dorsett jersey and has a Tony Dorsett video library of all the plays where he was so heroic, how can you not see that the end result of your consumption of his heroism is that he can't remember how to drive his kids home from school, that he's suffering from mood swings and depression, his kids are frightened of him, he's thought about suicide? I mean, he's saying all this publicly on TV. We are responsible for that ultimately. You cannot simply, or I believe, and my book is trying to argue, you can't cut the synapses between the joys of the joys and the pleasures of the game and what they cost to the people who play, and I would argue to the larger community.
Steve, I know you've heard this argument before. What do you say to the people who stand up and say, listen, this guy made millions of dollars to take those risks. He signed the contract as an adult, a college-educated adult, so he should be allowed to do this thing and not complain about it later on?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, every fan of every sport, but especially with football, because there's more of us and we've got a bigger suitcase. We all carry around a suitcase of rationalizations and excuses. And believe me, I say that as somebody who carried around that suitcase for 40 years, and it took me that long to unpack it. And this line about, well, the players, you know, they choose, they're adults. We're not talking about what the players decide to do here. We're talking about what the fans decide to do. That's the moral question here. Tony Dorsett is not a famous football player unless we make him famous. I think what fans do and what sports pundits specialize in, it's essentially their job, is to try to remove culpability from the fan. The fan is always a victim of some thug player or some greedy, team general manager, some incompetent, you know, oh, kids these days. It's always the fan who's the victim when you listen to, like, sports talk radio. But the truth is, if we don't like that Tony Dorsett has, you know, dementia, or that Ray Rice battered his girlfriend and got away with it, according to the league, we have the power. We're the only ones who have the power to turn away from the game until it changes significantly. We built the NFL, we built the football industrial complex, and we're the only ones who can unbuild it or reform it.
My guest is journalist and author Steve Almond. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Steve Almond about his new book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. I was interested to learn that people who follow football, play football, coach football, have understood for a long time that it can be dangerous, maybe not in quite the same way that we understand it today. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about the early history of the sport and how it actually became a sport from something that was really just sounds like a free-for-all.
Yeah, basically it started as a set of controlled riots. I mean, basically it was a hazing ritual, you know, when the freshmen would come in, and this is the late 1850s, 60s in there, when the, you know, freshmen would come in, the sophomores would basically beat them up. That was football. And it gradually merged with rugby and, you know, soccer and other sports, and it got more organized. And at a certain point, and this is something that I was really surprised to discover, it was seen as a promotional activity very early on. It's history by universities, by the emergent collegiate industry, if you will. A school like University of Chicago, for instance, before it had doorknobs for the buildings on campus, was hard at work building a football team because that was what was going to attract attention and generate revenues. In 1904, and I should say that all throughout its history, it has been trying to walk the line between extraordinary violence that people are drawn to and trying to either disavow or curb the violence. And that happened like in the 1860s, both Harvard and Yale banned the games. It was only played in colleges at that time. In 1904, 18 young men, both prep school and college kids, died. And they were a lot of other players were disfigured because there was no passing game at that time. It was really just people colliding with very inadequate equipment, and they were smashing into one another and doing a lot of damage. It got bad enough that Teddy Roosevelt, who's a pretty macho guy after all, said that he wanted to try to, you know, reform the game. But interestingly, so he called a lot of leaders together to the White House, and he helped initiate some very important reforms, including the forward pass, which really spread out the game and made it more oriented around passing and dodging other players as opposed to, you know, 10 men smashing into one another every play. But it has continued to be, throughout its evolution, profoundly violent. And I know people oftentimes say, well, what about hockey? What about boxing and so forth? Well, for one thing, football is a lot more popular. But what makes football particularly morally complex is that boxing is quite consciously two men trying to knock each other, or women trying to knock each other senseless. It's not hiding what it is. Hockey has fights and it has collisions, but those aren't an intricate part of the game. They're something that happens usually sort of by mistake or by as a kind of ritualized form of violence. Football has collisions built into it. There's no way to remove that. At the line of scrimmage, at every single place on the field, there are really major collisions. And as the players have gotten bigger and stronger and faster, basically they've become too big and strong and fast to be able to safely play the sport without these catastrophic results.
Why did they get so big? If you look at football games, you know, films from the middle part of this century, the most astonishing thing is how tiny the players look.
Yeah, it's amazing. So there's been a kind of arms race. And what's so insidious for me as I looked into football more deeply was that this is all coming from the NFL and the extraordinary visibility, popularity, and how lucrative the NFL is. And it's really trickled into the college game and now down into the high school game. So, in Texas, for instance, when there's a big high school program, you've got linemen who are 300 pounds. Well, that's bigger than the biggest players were 30 or 40 years ago. And it's an arms race because, after all, it is kind of an expression of our winner-take-all ethos. The idea, as Tony Dorsett was explaining, is simply to win games. And if you can get bigger and stronger and faster, including taking steroids, if whatever you can do to get bigger and stronger and faster, that's what you're going to do. If the only metric you use to measure your worth in your profession is getting bigger and stronger and faster, then you will find any way you can to do it, whether it's nutrition, training year-round, steroids, amphetamines, whatever is necessary. And that's the thing that makes football, I think, especially brutal, is it's like a public It's a very public way that we express our desire for excellence, but there are costs, human costs and moral costs, to trying to become so good at. And one of these is that players have gotten too big to play the game safely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Keith in Dallas. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Your guest may make the following quote from George Will of the Washington Post, but on the off chance that he didn't, I wanted to make sure your listeners heard it. And George Will has referred to USA football as showing the worst in America. It shows violence and committee meetings and really nothing more. I just want to make sure everybody heard that.
Thanks for your call.
I'll give you another just because there's so many wonderful quotes. So this is Theodore Roosevelt. He says, "I believe in rough, manly sports. I do not feel any particular sympathy for the person who gets battered about a good deal, so long as it is not fatal." Wow. Now, that's interesting because, in fact, part of the reason that Roosevelt called all those officials from colleges to the White House to try to reform the game is because his own son got his nose broken during a game. So it's really a situation where, and I think parents are struggling with this right now, we consume the game, and yet many parents are increasingly feeling like, including President Obama for that matter, I love the game and I hope they make it safer, but I'm not going to let I would let no son of mine, he said, play the game. The problem with that moral calculus is that you're essentially saying, basically, I'm okay with somebody else's son getting battered, maybe suffering dementia later in their life, but just not my son.
Well, we know George Will is such a baseball fan that maybe it's not surprising that he would say these things about football. But can you tell us a little bit about how football rose to primacy among American sports?
Well, I think one of the fundamental things you have to look at is that I think football really sort of, I call it the Doritos of, you know, sports. It's been perfectly engineered to hit our bliss point. And I mean by that it is both, it has this primal aggression to it, but it also has this really dense strategy. It's the intellectual secret vice because it is so strategically dense. And I think it also combines a feeling of, We're after a certain kind of physical grace and athleticism, but we also want to know, quote unquote, what somebody's made of. The Theodore Roosevelt, I want to see what somebody's made of, right? He was very proud of his Rough Riders, for instance, because they had played football, and that proved their masculine bona fides. I think there is a lot of the game that is really about trying to sort of prove what a man is. It's a kind of realm, an exalted realm, a cult, really, of masculinity. That's part of the reason for me that when you see a case like Ray Rice or, you know, the San Francisco 49ers player who was just convicted in a domestic abuse case and punished by the league, I think people react to that with this great surprise and outrage. But if the game selects for years and years and years and says to its players, we want you to be savage at the point of attack, we want you to play lights out football, we want you to control and channel your violence and aggression, and those of you who are the most savage and the most effective at suppressing your empathy are going to rise to fame and riches. When you say that to players for 20 years of their lives, how can you expect them to walk off the field and suddenly become gentlemen role models? A game that makes women basically sexual and ornamental objects and men these kind of ubermensches of masculine aggression, that's a recipe for disaster. We shouldn't sit there and act shocked that that pro athletes and football players in particular will get into situations where they're battering women. It's not a surprise, or it shouldn't be a surprise to us.
How is the National Football League a nonprofit organization?
They have good lobbyists, Chris, and they've been very canny as a business league for a long time. They basically went to Congress and said, we would like nonprofit status. And they made a deal. They're officially a business league, just like you might have a local real estate league. And all you need to be a part of this league is, say, $2 billion and some connections. So it's an abuse of what a nonprofit status should be. But I should say that the thing that the NFL did that is so brilliant is they basically also got an act of Congress passed that made them a legal monopoly. Rather than individually negotiating with networks, they negotiate collectively. It's either all of us or none of us. And that has turned out to be extraordinarily valuable. I mean, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. I had no idea when I first started looking at the NFL and football just how lucrative it is. You know, Roger Goodell ultimately wants the NFL, which has revenues of about $10 billion per year now. He wants to have it make $25 billion per year. That's as big as Nike or McDonald's. That's among the corporate behemoths of the world. And that's why when people say, well, I think the NFL will, they have the players' best interest at heart, or they'll find a way to make the game safer. They're a corporation. They have a cash register where their conscience should be. And that's not a judgment. It's an observation. That's what a corporation is supposed to do. The reality is that we are the ones who fund the game. And when Roger Goodell says he's going to make $25 billion in revenues, that means it's going to be us, the fans, who are paying, and usually an invisible cost, higher cable costs, higher costs for goods and services because advertising's so expensive. These are the things that we don't look at.
And I suppose depending on where we live, we might also be paying with our tax dollars, given that a lot of franchise owners get really big breaks to locate a team in a particular municipal area.
Oh, boy, do they. So let's take Houston as an example. Well, they lost the Oilers, and they wanted a team desperately. So the team owner paid the NFL $700 million in a franchise fee, and then the taxpayers of Houston paid $250 to help that billionaire build his stadium. And in fact, a study done by a Harvard economist found that the NFL, as a rule, gets 70% of its funding for its stadiums from the public. The catch, Chris, is that the taxpayers do not see a return on that investment. I know that one of the lines people use, oh, but, you know, it brings the community together, and it's such an engine. It's such a big industry, and it helps stimulate business in these cities and so forth. And the economists who have looked at this have basically said, look, the NFL is a circus. There are 8 games a year. They get a tremendous amount of funding from the public sector, and that money is actually siphoned from the public till, and it goes straight into the pockets of billionaires, because the revenues generated by those stadiums go directly to the NFL, and that then it's distributed to the owners. The reality in a place like Houston or Baltimore or any of the big cities, Detroit or St. Louis, is that $200 or $300 million in taxpayer funds, those should be used to stimulate real economic growth, to invest in crumbling schools or infrastructure, social services. There is something wrong with our cultural priorities when we spend that much public money to consume a violent game and enrich a bunch of billionaires.
To be fair, when taxpayers are footing the bill for these stadiums, typically they have voted on these proposals.
Some of them have voted, absolutely, and some of them have not. For instance, in Pittsburgh, the voters rejected a referendum to help fund the Heinz Stadium. It was ultimately called the Heinz Stadium. And the politicians essentially went against the will of the voters. One of the things I recommend in the epilogue of this book, where I try to suggest things that I think are good, you know, reasonable reforms, is you should not be allowed, no municipality or county should be allowed to approve public funding unless there is a return on that investment. If the people of Dallas want to build, the next Jerry's World, they want to build another stadium, they want to fund it, that's great. They should be able to do that, but they should see a return commensurate with what they've invested. Isn't that just common sense?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lynn in Dallas. Hello, Lynn.
Hi. I just love this topic and love this man. About 3 weeks ago in the news, it's talking about Dallas having the highest rate of hungry people in
right.
the nation, or per capita. I don't exactly know what it said. And at the same time, Jerry Jones made $2 billion off the Dallas Cowboys. And there's just something wrong with that picture.
You want to respond, Steve?
Well, let me give you a concrete example. You have a city like Baltimore. And what happens with this, it's called franchise free agency, and it's really the macroeconomics of the NFL. What happens is that our passion for the game gives these owners and the league tremendous leverage, and they use that essentially to say to particular cities, we're not going to come to your town, we're not going to start an NFL franchise unless we get a really great deal. We want a free stadium, we want a taxpayer-funded stadium, we want all the infrastructure covered, we don't have to pay much rent. And that's what Art Modell did in 1995 when he moved the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore. He got a stadium built for $200 million plus by the city of Baltimore, and he also got all the infrastructure and he got the revenues. He was playing there for 30 years rent-free, and he got every single form of revenue, ticket, parking, luxury boxes, all of it. And as a result of that, the value of his franchise was suddenly huge. He went from $163 million for the franchise to $600 million a few years later. This is the macroeconomics of it. It's sort of the 1% in the athletic world. And to me, what's heartbreaking about it is there are lots of economically vulnerable communities that could use the money that is going into the pockets of billionaires. And a lot of what we do with sports is we blame the players. They're pawns in this game. You know, if Jared Allen is making $18 million per year, that's a lot of money to us. His owner is making, you know, $580 million a year, and a lot of it is because the taxpayers have consented or been inveigled into essentially providing him a free place from which his games are broadcast. There's something fundamentally morally out of order when we look at the game, and this is true also if you think about where players come from. You know, several years ago, I reviewed the book The Blind Side by Michael Lewis, and I think Michael Lewis is one of our finest journalists. But one of the strange things about that book is that it's about a young African-American kid, a big kid who happens to have talent at football, and he's sort of adopted by a rich white couple. He's put in a private school, and he winds up going to, you know, their alma mater, predictably enough, and then he goes on to the pros, and it's sort of an inspirational story. But the kid at one point asks, he says, "I wonder if this couple would have chosen to rescue me if I was not a football player, if I was just some African-American kid who was going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's." And the book never answers that question. And we all know the answer to that question, Chris. The answer, if we're honest with ourselves, is no. The people who we choose to rescue, the kids who are developed as football players, oftentimes come from economically vulnerable neighborhoods, and they're often kids of color. When I was down in Miami, Florida, that is exactly the demographic that football was going after. And it was saying to them, it was saying to all of those kids, "I don't care about the content of your character. I don't care about your intellectual development. What I want is for you to perform beautifully on the field for my entertainment." I think Americans can do better than that. I honestly believe we're a better country than that.
My guest is journalist and author Steve Almond. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. If you want to be part of this conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Steve Almond about his new book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve, I want to go back to something that you said before the break, which was you referred to a player making $18 million a year, and then you said, but his owner is making X amount more. And it seems to me that language like that is not an accident. His owner.
That's right. It's really kind of eerie. You know, one of the things that people now watch as football has gone from something that's really just happening in the fall, there's been this growth of fantasy football in the off season, and it's like watching the stock market now. There's so much data around it. And one of the things that people watch is the NFL Combine. This is where the top players from college go to basically work out for the owners and coaches and so forth. And when you look at one of the chapters in this book is about really the racial aspect of football, which makes people very uncomfortable to talk about, but especially when you're looking at the South and the SEC and football in general, it is 2/3 African-American, and most of the fans and coaches and certainly all the owners are white, and they are called owners. So when you look at something like the Combine, what you are seeing is, if you just look at the visuals, it is an extravagantly monetized visual echo of the slave auction. And I say extravagantly monetized because I know people are going to get their hackles up and say, but those kids are getting paid money and this is a business and they're getting paid money. Yeah, I know. But if you look at the visuals, it is a bunch of mostly older white men inspecting the physical prowess of young African American men. How many pounds can they lift? How strong are they? How fast can they run? How high can they jump? I'm surprised they don't check their teeth, and maybe they do in some instances. And to me, that just should be disturbing for us. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book is ask a series of questions. And one of them is, why is it that our most popular form of cultural entertainment in 2014 consists of us watching mostly two-thirds African-American men, big muscled African-American men, coming up against one another, smashing into one another? Why is it that we then get to talk about those players and the way that they're talked about? He's a beast. Marshawn Lynch of the Seattle Seahawks is a beast. He's going into beast mode. He's a specimen. He's a stud. This is the language we use. I'm not accusing people of being racist for using those terms, but those terms are utterly objectifying. They are taking a human being and describing them like an animal. And I don't think there's any coincidence that a country that was born out of slavery and has managed to, you know, reckon with that in some ways, but carries a certain legacy, is one in which, for instance, in the SEC, the big Southern, you know, Southeastern Football Conference, you have 80% of the players who are African American, many of them from economically vulnerable neighborhoods, and the fans who are consuming them as they are bashing into one another and, you know, doing one another great damage and gathering, you know, great plaudits, are predominantly white. Those same players who we think are so amazing, we cheer for so loud on the field, if they walked by us on a dark street at night, how would we react? What would we think? What would our feelings and fears and anxieties be? There's a lot of stuff that people don't want to unpack because it makes them feel very uncomfortable, but it's so out in the open with football. We treat these guys like they're really our possessions in a certain way. We feel absolutely no compunction about railing against them, this guy's a thug and that guy's greedy and so forth. And yet the fact of the matter is, as we're sitting there on a couch as munching our Cheetos, we don't have, it's such an entitled viewpoint, we don't have the courage or valor to face even one NFL hit, let alone having to go on the field and face it every single day in practice and then on Sunday.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Marcos on the line in Dallas. Hi, Marcos.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Really great conversation. I read an article a while back, and it brought up the issue of just what you were talking about right now, that predominantly black in the NFL, and the problems they were having off the field. And the article went on to say that because of the concussions and all of the information that's coming out about that in the NFL, that a lot of the educated white families are starting to pull their kids from football, where minority families are leaving their kids in football. And it seems kind of disturbing. And I'm wondering what you thought about that trend and how you think it might affect the NFL going forward.
Well, it's a great question. Look, this is already in effect. There's already a disproportionate number of players who come from economically vulnerable neighborhoods and who are kids of color. I think it's going to get even more dramatic. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell, the wonderful writer, calls it the ghettoization of the game. It's going to become that much more extreme. You know, I spent part of the reason I wanted to write the book is I wanted to write about a lot of different experiences I've had that I really hadn't synthesized or put together. One of the things I did when I was a reporter in Miami is I spent a lot of time in a place called Liberty City in a housing development called the James Scott Homes. It was called the Canyon by the people who lived there. And in the Canyon, it was like most housing developments in this country in very poor areas. It's basically a village of depressed women and children. And the young men in particular, there was a feeling in the community itself that football was going to be the salvation of one or two of these young guys, and that the kids themselves were violent by their very nature, and that football was the only way to control them. And this is a line that you hear from fans all the time, but it's the ticket out. A kid who might otherwise never get to college gets an opportunity to go to college, and it's such a load. It is such BS. Think about what we're really saying. What we're saying is, if you're really good at football, we'll let you come to our school and play for our football team, and maybe you'll get an education, but the most important thing, the reason you're at that school in the first place, is because you entertain us on Saturday. And what we really value in you isn't the content of your character. It's not your moral development. It's not your intellectual development. What we really value is that you're really good physically. You're fierce. You've been able to control and channel your violence. And one out of every 500 players in high school seniors, is going to make the NFL and probably stay there just for 3 or 4 years. That's the average stay in the NFL. That's 1 out of 500. What football is the lotto mentality. What our culture doesn't do is think about the other 499 kids, poor kids, maybe poor kids of color. We've got other ways that they wind up getting taken out of the system, and it usually involves a jail cell. What we need to do fundamentally is stop thinking that football is the economic salvation of the game. One of the things about the Canyon that was so amazing was that there were all these murals of Martin Luther King and all these sayings by Martin Luther King. And I kept thinking, what would Martin Luther King think of the situation where football, a game that is inherently violent and is inherently exploitative and objectifying, is seen as the salvation of these kids? How would he, who advocated consistently for nonviolence, for finding a way to create real equality of opportunity and to value people for their character, for the content of their character, what would he make of the fact that these values have been internalized by the African-American community and that we now think that that's really the way to solve the problem? Think about how many celebrities in this country, if you just close your eyes and say, think of 10 African-American celebrities. How many of them are going to be athletes? Why aren't they doctors? Why aren't they astronauts? Why aren't they dot, 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 dot? I think, in a way, football is seen in sports in general, but football in particular, I think it's this weird subconscious form of restitution that we have a few African-American people who we reward incredibly lavishly because they can perform for us on Saturday or Sunday. And the rest of the poor people of color in this country, in terms of policy, we really don't care about that much. We'd rather they're just out of view.
So you are not naive enough to think football is going anywhere in this country, but you do have a list, as you mentioned, of remedies in sort of appendix to the book. Revoke the NFL's nonprofit status, require that allocation of public funds for sports facilities be approved by public referendum, parental discretion warnings before football games. Talk about that. You're saying let people know before they watch a game with their kids, there might be very violent content in this.
Well, it's not a might. There's going to be violent content, and it's not a fiction. It's real human beings. I mean, part of the problem, Chris, that's more fundamental here is these people are human beings, and you have, as a Christian or just as a U.S. citizen, we should have some moral responsibility for other people. If you want to watch an escapist fiction, you know, Star Wars or whatever it is, or Harry Potter or some horror film, okay, you kind of know, even though you might have limbic reactions to those things, that it's a fiction. Football is not a fiction. Those guys really do get hurt. When I was 11 years old, I saw Jack Tatum, my favorite player for the Oakland Raiders, put his shoulder down and put Daryl Stingley, a famous wide receiver, down on the ground and paralyze him. I saw that with my own two eyes on TV. I assumed as an 11-year-old kid, I was terribly worried. You know why I was worried, Chris? I was worried they were going to stop allowing me to watch football. I should have been worried that I just watched a fellow human being get crippled. But instead, because I was a fan and because nobody else seemed to be upset, the announcers weren't upset, my dad was. I mean, you know, we were a little bit concerned, but we also wanted the game to move on. You know, that's a really unnatural reaction. There's an amazing moment in this new documentary called We Could Be King, and it's about high school football in the Philadelphia area. But in one scene, there's two star players, and one of them is a little guy, and he gets the ball, and he's knocked down pretty savagely by a defensive player just in practice. And the other star player immediately has this incredible reaction. He gets very upset and he starts weeping and he says to the coaches, you know, that could have happened to any of us. Sal's, and he thinks that his friend, I mean, for a while, I think it's unclear whether this kid is ever going to get up, if he's dead, if he's paralyzed. What that kid is doing that seems so unnatural in a football film is having the appropriate moral reaction to what he's seen. And that's what I'm saying here is if you're a parent, most parents in well-heeled neighborhoods are not going to allow their kids to play football. But what message does it send those kids if you then watch the game and you don't even say to them, you know, there's extreme violence in this game? You know, how do you have that conversation with your children when you are essentially saying, I watch football, it's the All-American game, no problems here. And yeah, that guy might have gotten paralyzed, but hey, it's the risk. He gets paid a lot of money.
Another of your recommendations is to create a helmet that records every sub-concussive hit. These are the ones that don't necessarily even take people off the field during play, but can be right. damaging over time. Include graduation rates in a college team's national ranking. Talk about that.
Right. Well, all of these are intended to create a different set of incentives. So when I suggest that players, that one thing that football could do immediately is create a weight limit, that's because the incentives right now, as we talked about, are to make the players bigger and bigger and bigger. They're not playing at their natural weights. They're more powerful as sort of missiles, essentially launching into one another. The incentives at every level from the NFL down should be for people to play at their natural weight, so they're not so dangerous to themselves and others. The same thing is true with a graduation rate or requiring a 3.0 GPA for high school students. You're saying to the football players, look, you can play this game, but you also have to take your academics seriously, and you don't get to play football unless we also are developing your mind. We make sure that you're prepared for life after the game. Because one of the things that players will tell you over and over again is you essentially take these kids, you segregate them from the rest of the population. They spend almost all their time thinking about football and being valued for their abilities as a football player, and they're totally unprepared for life beyond that. It's really a kind of permanent boyhood. It's a very regressed state to be in. And the same thing is true for subconcussive hits. Coaches can say everything they want, but we're trying to make the game safer. Until there is an incentive put in, coaches are not going to start saying to players, do not lead with your head, because you're going to get yanked out of the game if you get any more G-forces registered in your helmet. We have to create incentives that actually push people away from behaviors that are destructive to themselves, to others, to our own morality.
Obviously, you want fans to take some responsibility for the way that football has become and the toll that it takes on the people who are directly involved in the game. What response have you heard from people who say, Steve, you've just ruined this for me?
Well, I've ruined it for me. I mean, like, as righteous as I can sound, like, I am going to be jonesing worse than any of you, because you're all going to find some excuse to watch the game. Okay, this guy doesn't like it. Yes, he might have a few points, but I'm still going to watch my Cowboys on Sunday. You know, I've essentially said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I love the game. And I think it's one of the most, I mean, it's a place of refuge for me. And it has been for years, where I don't have to worry about all this heavy moral stuff. I can just go watch the ball game and bond with my next door neighbor, who is, by the way, furious at me for having written this book, because we're fans, we love the game together. But ultimately, it is upon the fans. All the book is saying is not we should ban football. It's not, you know, these are exactly the things we should do to make it safe. It's not even about reforming the game. It's about having a conversation about why, at this point in our history, we need such a beautiful but brutal game in order to feel united, in order to feel our feelings. That's what I want fans to try to reckon with and make their own decision. I've had a range of reactions from, you know, calling me all sorts of, you know, you can imagine sorts of names I'm called. They're inevitably, like, incredibly degrading and usually have to do with implying that I'm somehow womanly, because anybody who doesn't like football isn't a real man. Mm-hmm. But there have also been people who have said, well, I'm a lifelong fan, but I've been struggling with these feelings, these misgivings, and I'm going to stop watching. And it's not that I want that reaction, but I want people to be in that state of struggle. The things that we love have deep meaning, and we should think not just about their beauty and their allure, but also about what they cost us. That's what I want people to do, to be in that struggle.
Steve Allman's new book is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
It was good to be with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.